There are interesting people in disc golf, and there are boring people in disc golf. Here's one of each on the Fish Golf Broadcast. For this episode of the Fish Golf Broadcast, I, Andrew Fish, sat down with Casey White. Casey, what you thinking about?
I'm thinking about that's a dumb name for the podcast.
Well, this is going great already. Thanks. It's a working title. We'll see where it goes. Casey, last week we were both at the same tournament at Crush on the Concho in San Angelo, Texas. And that was my first time there. It was not your first time there.
It was my third time there.
Okay. And you had a mishap, a misadventure last year, right?
I would say it was a miraculous incident.
Okay.
Of involving my van side door, where my dog that I had previously in the van had tried to chew her way out of the van multiple times, which led to no help of the van's health. And one day, the van got chewed to the point that the side door would not open, nor would it even think about opening, whether it was locked, unlocked, anything.
Right. So you're in a big van.
Mm-hmm.
It's got two front seats. It's got like front doors, mm-hmm, and then side door and back door, but only one side door.
Only one side door.
So if that doesn't work, then how do you get into the living space?
I had to this was 5 months of living this way. I had to basically constantly have my passenger seat slid all the way backwards and never put anything in the way, because that was my way of getting in and out of the house no matter what I was doing, whether I was loading in groceries or loading in laundry or just straight up just getting in and out daily life with or without stuff in my hands. And it was a task, and like it became normal life, but normal life reminded me every single day how miserable it was to go through that door. And the way that I described it to other people is, imagine grabbing your groceries, going to the grocery store, filling up as much as you can possibly hold in your house, and instead of just going in your front door and going right to your fridge, you have to go through your bulkhead, down the stairs, up through the basement, and then into your kitchen with every single bag of groceries that you have. Even though there's a way shorter way just straight through the front door.
That you can see,
but the front door don't open. And it was a miserable time in my life, because it was just like my happiness of van life was almost taken away. Like I was so inaccessible for other people who would approach my van, because mm-hmm, I would just, most of my time was spent sitting in my passenger seat with my door or my window down. And it's just like, it's a lot less approachable, even just for like fans and friends, even if like my friends know that I'm in there. Like with the side door wide open, it's very inviting for conversation and for just anything, just like a hey or a mm-hmm, hello, you know what I mean? So losing that part of my van life was pretty crucial. Like I basically had to either sit outside in a lawn chair or just like sit in my van with nobody with me, essentially.
And like, do you have lights inside?
I do have lights inside, okay, but I very rarely like to turn them on. And that is actually a big issue as well, is lighting.
It's like basically windowless,
mm-hmm,
void.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. And, you know, every single morning I would get out of my bed and I would hope for a miracle and reach for my side door. And it would just give me like a nothing to resist. Ugh. On the button, and it would just it wouldn't even click or nothing. It would just go blunk.
And how long were you dealing with this?
This was 5 months. It was October to March.
Okay. And you were wintering in Florida, so mm-hmm, like you would want that door open.
Oh yeah. And I sat in my passenger seat with my front windows down every single day, and that was my way of life, essentially. And it wasn't the worst, because I was hanging out with Brandon Hauer and Noah Fiveash, and Brandon Hauer's side door worked. So Noah and I would grab chairs and we would sit outside of Brandon's van while his side door was open. So at least we had some sort of van life hangout. But me being the host was completely taken away and unavailable.
You couldn't pull up opposite his van and do that.
Yep. So the morning of the Crush on the Concho, Marky Chapp had just rolled into town. I hadn't seen him since October.
And he's the best player in Massachusetts, is that correct?
He's the best forehand in Massachusetts.
If only I could say that with a straight face.
You almost pulled it off.
Oh, man. So I wake up on the Crush on the Concho. This is day one. We're playing two rounds shotgun start.
Yep.
And every single day, the way I always do, I depressingly look at my side door, reach for the handle, and just get nothing out of it. Except for the first time, I had resistance. And I hit it, and I saw light through the cracks of the door. And it was so mind-blowing. Like, I had to actually ask myself, like, am I awake? Am I actually awake, or am I still sleeping, and this is a dream? Because there's nothing that changed. There is absolutely not a single thing that changed from that day, from the past 5 months, every single day getting up out of bed and trying to see if the door would work. It just would never go. And for some reason, this day, it decided to open and show light. So I'm jumping up and down. I run out of the van. I'm banging on Marky's bus door, screaming and yelling. This is 7 a.m. in the middle of a campground. I'm waking up the whole campground screaming that my side door opened. My side door opened. I can't believe it.
Which sounds like an elaborate metaphor for something to the rest of the campground.
Yeah, yeah. But all they knew was that Casey White was having a good day.
Yeah.
And, you know, we deal with the rest of our morning, eat breakfast, make some coffee, go out for the first round of the shotgun start. I'm telling everybody I see about my side door. I'm like, my life is great. Mm-hmm. Nothing can take me down. I could shoot the worst round of my life right now, and absolutely nothing could take me off of the way I feel right now. And I'm going through the round and making some putts, feeling good. You know, the round's going well. I'm like, man, this is a great day. Like, what an amazing day. Then the round starts to go on, and I get a bad break here. I get a bad break there. I'm getting a couple bogeys, and I'm starting to see things not go my way. And I start to think to myself, I'm like, you know what? I bet you're going to go back to your van, and your side door is not going to work. Like, just because why did it work the first time? Why would it keep working? Sure enough, I finish my round, don't feel great about it, but I'm not, like, too worked up about it. But I am very worried about my side door. And I get back from my round. We're about to have lunch. Go up to the door, nothing. Just no response from the door. Just that dead handle. And I sit on the side of my van with my head down, and I'm just so upset. And people are coming and asking, like, oh, how'd the round go? I'm like, honestly, the round, like, who cares? I'm like, I'm not even mad about that. I'm mad because my freaking side door won't work after it just did. And Jared Stoll was with us, and he was like, well, what's wrong with it? And I'm like, dude, you tell me. So he's like, well, you mind if I take a look? I'm like, dude, knock yourself out. So he gets in my van. And this is the other thing, is like, people have to crawl through my passenger door into my van. Like, it's not a very attractive way to say, hey, you want to get in my van? You know what I mean?
And which is already a delicate prospect for most people.
Of course.
It's socially acceptable to disc golfers, but, you know, you can't just go up to, you know, a pretty lady on the street.
There is a lot of ways to show people my van, and like, with the side door working, nobody even has to stand within 10 feet of it to see my living space and to like understand I live and how I built it out and everything like that. But with the side door not working, they literally had to crawl into the cave that was my passenger door through the back.
So I think that's important context for Jared to understand like how hellish this living situation is. But does he have any mechanical proclivity? Like, what made him think he could solve this?
I don't know. I think that Jared is just like a problem solver naturally.
Okay.
And he just was like, well, I mean, I have never heard of anybody having this problem. So like, let's see what we can do about it. And basically all I needed was his motivation. I was not in any mood to stop him. I was like, you are motivated and you're willing to help. I will allow you to help me in any way you can. So he just starts to pull some latches and, you know, look at the cords and everything like that. And a lot of the wires were chewed off.
And what's the situation of the, like, inside panel? Is that still attached were you unscrewing?
The panel was removed because the pop lock wouldn't lock or unlock anymore from the key fob. So everything was manual, but the pop lock would fall through the hole. So I ripped the panel off because I was like, well, if it's going to drop through, I'm not going to like fish it out every single time. I'm going to make sure that it's going to be easily accessible, whether it's stationary or not.
And I just want to revisit this. The pop lock drops.
Yes, it does.
Okay, carry on.
And I actually did figure out a way. I put a zip tie underneath the pop lock so it would stay up and I can pull it, push it, whatever. And it's like easy peasy. But Jared starts to, you know, use like his fingers get behind the metal and like you can't really see anything what you're doing.
Okay.
And I'm watching him and like I'm just trying to see if there's any progress to be made, like what he's even working with, like what he's able to access. And as I'm watching, looking over his shoulder, for some reason I just like had this like thing that made me look up at the door handle, reach for it, and press it.
It's just like divine inspiration told you?
The same thing from the morning of the resistance, and I pop it, and I see the light. And I literally look at Jared, and I'm freaking out again because it's open again.
Yeah.
And I'm like, do you think that what you just did is repeatable, or do you think that that was all luck? He says, honestly, I think that was all luck. Like, I have no idea what caused that door to open. And I'm like, well, nobody is shutting this door. So we're determined to fix it. And we have to go play a second round, though. So we pile up a bunch of tables and chairs.
This was all at lunch?
This is at lunch at a two-round shotgun start.
Oh, my God. Like, this is... That's a very fine timeline to try to make this work.
Yeah.
Okay, so you pile up chairs.
So we pile up chairs and tables, and we go and play the second round.
And we're just disguising to the rest of the campers that, you know, this door actually shouldn't be closed.
Exactly. And, like, Mostly, I wasn't worried about, like, security issues. I wasn't worried about somebody, like, coming in and stealing stuff. I was worried about somebody, like, being like, oh, this door is shut or isn't shut properly.
Oh, somebody well-intentioned.
Exactly. So yeah. I was worried about somebody well-intentioned, actually. And even just somebody who could lean on it to latch the door. I was like, these tables and chairs, nobody's going to be able to touch the door. And so we go and play a second round. Goes better than the first round. And then we go, as soon as we get back, we're like, let's get right into it. And the first thing we have to do is pull off the floor, the step, because it has the access to like the roller track.
Okay.
But all those screws were rusted and what do you call it? Stripped.
Yeah.
So we had to take Jared's car to Lowe's. I had to buy a full power drill and one of those drill sets that like...
To tap it.
Yes, exactly. You tap it out and
yep.
pull it out. All that was great and good. And actually, the side door had some issues before I bought it. That's not the reason that the lock and unlock was unresponsive. That was all because of the dog. But the point is, I had the part to replace the side door the entire time I owned the van. It just never came to the point where I'm like, oh, I have to fix this side door. And like, nor did I have the tools or means to do so, really. But today was the day. Like, it was not an option.
Yep.
So we get through the whole thing. We take off the old part. We start to put on the new bracket. And, you know, this whole process started at 7 a.m. when the door first opened. And now the sun's going down. It's like 8:30 at night. And we've got a tea time at whatever, 8:30, 9 a.m. the uh-huh. next morning. So, like, it's not like this is just like, oh, we'll do it when we do it. Like, no, we were determined and we had a time frame. And so Jared is like, we don't have a star bit big enough for this. And I'm like, well, we are staying in a campground with a bunch of people we know.
So you've like opened all the toolboxes that y'all have in your vans and cars.
And apparently out of my friends, I'm the only one that carries a toolbox. But
that seems like an indictment of disc golfer's preparation.
Yeah. You live and you learn. I think that that's like basically the easiest way to say it is okay. Like you know you need the things you need when you find yourself needing them, and somebody who hasn't needed them yet, they don't know how badly they need them yet.
Yeah.
But anyway, I go over to the first campsite I see, big fifth wheel trailer, a bunch of cars parked around it, and I just walk up and say, does anybody have a socket set I can use? And the first guy, like one guy in the first group I ask is like, yeah, sure. He brings me over to his car, the trunk of his car. The only thing in this man's trunk is a ginormous socket set. And I was like, this is the day. Like, this is the day. Like, this is Casey White's day. It, like, the universe is going well.
Yeah, we're back to the, like, unbridled enthusiasm of the morning.
Yes, exactly. Yep. Exactly. So he brings it over. And I'm just like thanking him for his help. And, you know, this is a disc golf tournament. There's a million disc golfers around. We're all camping on the property.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes up to my van, and the first thing he says is, dude, is this your house? And a light bulb pops up in my head, and I go, oh, my God, this guy's not a disc golfer. This is a random guy at this campground on whatever, March, the first weekend in March, that he happens to be camping here, and the only thing in his trunk is a socket set, and he's letting me use it to fix my van. And within a couple minutes, we were able to unscrew the old one, pop the new one on. Thing was fully functional, and we haven't had an issue since.
That is marvelous.
It really is. And now I have a socket set of my own. I got it for Christmas from my stepdad.
Mm-hmm.
And before I left for tour, one of the first things I did was take the whole thing apart, put it all back together like I knew what I was doing, just in case when it comes up to that point that I am going to be fully capable of fixing my side door if the time comes again.
Mm-hmm. And that's a very determined dog.
Oh, right? Relentless is a good word for it. Not really determined, because she wasn't really sure what she was determined for, but she was relentless. Like, she had a metal crate, and the metal crate became unusable because of how warped and bent it became because of what she was able to do with, like, the force of her teeth, like, pulling on it. That the crate, you know how, like, if you pop a couple locks, it'll fold down to the side? Mm-hmm. It wouldn't stand up anymore. It was at, a full-time lean, and the door wouldn't shut anymore. So, but anyway, what would happen is she would bend the crap out of it, escape out, and then, like, still have
in
a van to escape out of. You know what I mean? But the worst thing about the crate was that she would escape. She was clever enough to escape, but not smart enough to know that now she is keeping herself away from water.
Oh, no.
So it just became a point where, like, the crate had to go. And the weird thing is, like, I could play a whole day of disc golf and, like, do other things and then come back to her, and she would just be, like, sleeping in the chair or whatever.
And it is air conditioned in there. You're not
Fan. No air conditioning, but okay. There's a fan running. And, like, you know, depending on what season it is.
Most this was of the year, the that's good enough.
This was in the fall in Massachusetts, so the weather was quite nice.
Okay. Anybody from PETA or other animal rights organizations, Casey White is not your target today.
Not anymore. And but the craziest thing is I could be gone for a while, like hours.
Yeah.
And come back, and she would just be sleeping on the chair. But then whenever it would just be like, oh, let's just run to Walmart. I'm going to go with my dad, and she can just stay in the van. It'd be 10 minutes. That's when hell would break loose.
Boy.
It was the shortest possible time that I could be away that the problems would happen and the chaos would ensue. Like, it's not when, oh, she hasn't been out of the van for hours. No, it'd be like the shortest little instance of you got to stay in the van for these couple minutes, that's when the biggest chaos would ensue.
I'm Brian Earhart, and I like to listen to the Fish Golf broadcast while I salt my pasta water.
Hi, my name is Chandler Fry, and I like to listen to the Fish Golf broadcast when I stop at rest stops and go to the bathroom.
If you like where this show is headed, stick around for part two. We'll never barrage you with 11 minutes of droning external ads to start the show, so please support the Fish Golf broadcast by visiting discgolfbra.com for hats and other apparel. Fish stamp discs are available at fishdiscgolf.com and daddydiscgolf.com, and you can save 10% on upperparkdiscgolf.com with the code Andrew10 on backpacks and other items. And now, more lies and outrageous claims from our guest, met with calm reason by Fish.
Casey, another thing you had mentioned to me was two kind of like opposing items about shots you were trying to throw or how you were game planning for certain things. The first one was like throwing really difficult technical shots just for fun.
Mm-hmm. I think it started just by speaking to the person that I was becoming, which was an incredible thing. My first year on the full-time tour was 2021.
Yeah.
And I had my ex-girlfriend with me and the dog. And then I became a free man, and I could do whatever I wanted, and I could play whatever tournaments I wanted and throw whatever shots I wanted. And mind you, I also became pretty financially secure just because I had low cost of living, and I started to get a better contract and, you know, just make better things happen for myself. I started to make some money with YouTube. So it almost gave me some freedom from the scorecard. Where in 2021, I would describe myself as I was like a slave to my scoreboard.
Mm-hmm.
And that depicted how I acted for the rest of the day. and how I treated myself as a player and all those things, because financially it was not an option for me to play bad because I was a sole income for my household.
Yeah.
And it was not really sustainable, honestly. Like, I happened to play the best golf of my entire life when that kicked off, and that's the reason that I was able to keep going the way I was. But, like, if I don't play the best golf of my career in that couple-month stretch, like, I don't know where I would have ended up even by the end of the year.
And you can kind of make that, like, that mentality, that that necessity of playing well work for a little while. But
for,
like,
a little while.
But if you get hurt, it's all over.
That's a tough life. Yeah, you can't even, it's not sustainable. That's basically the easiest way I say it. So at the beginning of the 2022 season, I found myself, maybe, let's just say I'll throw it inside the circle for birdie and then just completely banned the putt. And I would just go, like, shrug it off. Like, eh, that wasn't a great effort. You know what I mean? In 2021, me, I would be
rage.
I would have smoke coming out of my ears. Like, I wouldn't, like, rage, but internally I would be freaking on fire.
Your face doesn't really hide that either.
No,
huh?
It doesn't. It doesn't at all. So, like, people who know me know how I'm feeling at any given moment, really. And in 2022, I just found myself taking those strokes and just really, really shaking them off. And I wasn't really mad about it, because, like I said, like, I was still playing good, but I wasn't, like, killer instinct out on the course. You know what I mean? And eventually that just developed into me caring less about throwing every single shot the way statistics would say that this is my best chance to score. Mm-hmm. And I found myself throwing a lot of shots that my brain wanted to see.
Can you give me an example of that?
Yeah. So let's say, me as a player, the most comfortable shot I could possibly have is a 9-speed overstable sidearm on a hyzer 250 feet.
Okay.
Like, there's no questions asked for me. That would be my shot. A left to right sidearm with an overstable disc.
One angle, hit it and quit it.
And then I started messing around with my P2 that's beat to crap. And I was like, if I throw this thing on a spike hyzer on the left side of the fairway, people are going to think I shanked the crap out of this thing. Little do they know, this is the flippiest disc they've ever seen, and it's going to turn all the way over and almost ace it, and it'll be freaking awesome.
Uh-huh.
And I just started to crave that shot. But another reason that I started to crave that shot is a part of the reason of, like, me being, like, financially secure. And in the prior year, I had somebody always watching me who was depending on my score to make us financially secure.
Huh.
So the freedom of my mind was never, in 2022, was never going to stop myself from doing what I wanted to, because I can, and nobody can tell me what to do. And it not only made me kind of change the mindset of, like, whatever you do, you have to do what's smartest for your game, get the best score possible, get the highest payout, all those things. They weren't in my mind. What was in my mind was, I am going to prove to my card mates every single round that I am capable of crazier shots than they are. And I am going to throw the most memorable shot of the day for the entire card. They might beat me by a stroke. They might beat me by four. But that one shot that I threw on hole 16, they're not going to forget about that one. And I just started to crave that. I don't know why. And it's almost like a little bit of, like, a Simon effect of just, like, making the impossible possible. But at the same time, like, I was using it more personally, and I was taking a shot that, let's say, was my most uncomfortable tournament shot, which is just say a putter backhand. And on that overstable sidearm hole, I was throwing a putter backhand and executing it perfectly. Like, there was nothing more rewarding.
Was there any fear in doing that? Or was it just like, it doesn't matter if this doesn't work because I'm trying something really, really hard?
I think there was more fear in throwing the simple shot and messing it up that's why I'm like, if you're scared of messing up the simple shot, then throw the shot that's going to, like if I throw that standard overstable sidearm and I execute it perfectly, I'm not, my brain is not going to get any dopamine from that. It's just going to be like, yep, I've seen it a million times. But if I'm able to pure the line on a vertical hyzer all the way to flat and then dive it to the right, like shape that shot in my mind and then bring it to life, mm-hmm. like there is nothing more rewarding for me. Whether or not I make the next putt is up to me. But like the fact that I executed the first shot, like the fact that I could have aced it, like the thought of that actually happening and that being a possibility was way more overdriving than the positives of me executing the basic forehand.
Okay. So this seems, it seemed to me that that was a little bit at odds with how you said you had prepared for the Champions Cup last year. Mm-hmm. Champions Cup, new major in 2022, four rounds at W.R. Jackson. So like really technical, well thought out course. How did you go to prepare for that?
So W.R. Jackson is a course that's been on the tour for a while.
In various forms, yes. But kind of took a hiatus after 2017 Worlds.
Yes, the last time they played it in a tournament at any Elite Series was the 2019 Hall of Fame Classic.
Okay.
And that is still the exact same layout that it stands as today. And I knew that all of my peers, everybody around me, has already played this course. They've already competed on it. They've practiced on it. I have never played it before in my life. And I, the weeks leading up to the Champions Cup was the Music City Open Silver Series and the Open at Tallahassee Silver Series.
Yeah.
I had no interest in going back to the Music City Open, so I just said, I'm going to skip out on that. I'm going to go straight to Augusta. Mm-hmm. And I spent about 2.5 weeks in Augusta and just practicing the course all by myself, music in my ears, just living in my own space. The only people I saw when I was on that course were the employees of the PDGA. And the first day that I showed up to play W.R. Jackson, you got to pay like $3 at the gate to get into the park, and yep. then you have to pay $3 to play the course at the pro shop. And when the first day that I walked into practice, the lady at the counter asked me if I was a PDGA member. And I literally told myself, I'm like, this is how early you're here to prepare for this tournament.
Yeah.
This is how much more preparation you're going to have than everybody else here.
There's you go in there and see like Downs or Big Dog or somebody, they're going to ask if you circled the wrong date on your calendar.
There is a major at this location in just a couple weeks, and they have no idea that that's what I'm here for because I'm here so early. And I think that that initial reaction alone led to just like an incredible thing in my mind of like, nobody's going to beat you on this course. Like,
okay.
You're going to go out there, you're going to have all the time in the world to get every single shot down. The most important thing that I was focused on, because everybody else seemed to have played the course and tournament way more than I have gotten to in any form,
right,
is I'm going to play Casey White's game and Casey White's game only. Nobody's going to show me what disc to throw. Nobody's going to tell me how to shape this fairway.
Yeah.
I'm going to look at the fairway, dissect it myself, and over 5 to 6 practice rounds, I'm going to know exactly what disc I'm going to throw.
Yeah.
And at one point in the week, I've never seen another human throw a single other hole, like a single hole in person on this course. But I knew for a fact that I was throwing shots that I literally said to myself, I'm like, nobody is landing here. Nobody has ever thrown a disc to this spot. I was just like, I was my own hype man. I was going for the most aggressive shots and like loosely keeping score. And like I was blowing my own mind with what I was capable of on that course, and how comfortable I felt was so, so rewarding. And then we go to the week of the tournament. I had already done my practice. Everybody sure. else is showing up. I did go down to Tallahassee for a couple days to play the tournament and mm-hmm. did well. And then when I came back to Augusta, everybody, you know, the parking lot's full, the course is loaded with people.
And it's kind of hard to practice mm-hmm. properly then. Oh. Like you can't backtrack yep. and play a hole again.
Nope.
There's groups
and
everywhere.
That's what I was doing when I was by myself. If I wanted to throw a hole again, I'd pick up my discs and I'd go back to the tee and I'd throw it again. No questions asked. Uh-huh. Like that's what I wanted to do, and that's what I was allowed to do. There was nobody else on the course. And I did play one round the week of the Champions Cup with Jeff Brick and Simon, and I just found myself just missing.
And who's Jeff?
Jeff Brick is a local to the Augusta, Georgia area. He is a caddy at Augusta National, the golf course.
And also a very good Masters disc golf player.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he's one of Simon and I's great friends, and he allowed me the place to stay for the couple weeks that I was there, obviously free, and you can't go wrong with that. And I kind of fell in love with the Augusta area and just hanging out there and playing one of the best courses in the world. Like, there's really just, it was like a perfect storm in a way.
Yeah. So Jeff, with his golf experience, golf caddying experience, what was it like talking with him?
It was actually a very important thing in that experience, because every single practice round I would play, I'd play it by myself, but, you know, nobody's watching me. Nobody's there to see what I'm doing except for me. Mm-hmm. So I'd go home and I would tell him about my round, and we would basically go through every single hole, and I would tell him, this hole, I'm throwing this, and I don't think there's any way I could possibly mess it up. And he's like, really? And I'm like, why? He's like, well, that's actually one of the harder holes in the course. I'm like, are you serious? I'm like, I've never felt more comfortable on a tee shot in my life. And like, that's the thing, really, is like, I'm not seeing people misfiring or getting bad kicks. I'm just throwing my line, and I'm throwing it to the point that I can see the basket. And like, typically you can't see the basket on that shot. The hole I'm thinking of in particular is hole 15 on W.R. Jackson. The sure. big flex shot.
Like, yeah.
I'm throwing my drive to a point that I can see the basket on my second shot.
And that hole's basically 800 feet, covering a couple valleys, and the basket is like 25 vertical feet down a slope.
Very intense slope.
If you're seeing this basket in its new position, then like, you have thrown an absolute crush.
Yes.
And you better get up and down for
exactly,
it.
Exactly. Well, I mean, it's either a little chip sidearm or like a little like mid-range jump putt.
Yeah.
That's like, what more can I ask for? And just hearing Jeff's feedback and just asking a little bit more about my strategy on some of the holes, dissecting what my goals are for the course. He had heard over the weeks that I was there, and come time for the tournament, he goes, what's your goal? And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, well, like, what's your goal for this week? Like, you've seen, like, you've done your preparation and you're pretty determined. Like, what is your goal for the Champions Cup? And I'm like, you know, I really don't know, but I want to be in first place after the first fucking round. That's what I said to him.
Okay.
And he was like, that's a pretty good goal. And I'm like, yeah, like, I think so too. And I had scored some practice rounds. The best round I had shot was 8 under. Well, I go out to the first round of the Champions Cup. I was actually one of the morning tee times.
Yeah.
And I found myself 4 down through 6, rode the front 9 out, and then closed out with, like, I think at least two birdies on 17 and 18 with some a great putt on 17. Mm-hmm. I walk off the course and I'm feeling great. I'm like, yep, I knew I was capable of a good round on this course. And I look at my scorecard and I go, no way. I shot 11 under, 3 strokes better than any of my practice rounds, where, like, in the practice rounds, I'm doing like the, oh, I'm a foot into the rough, let me just kick myself out the fairway so I don't break my hand on this tree. Like, giving myself those favorable runs, I only shot 8 under. And now I go out to the tournament and I shoot 11 under and I am in first place after the first round.
So the goal you already set for yourself with Jeff achieved. Were you able to sustain that throughout the tournament?
So the issue that I ran into there was I set that as my goal. I did. I said it out loud. And the fact that I did it, it was almost like I tricked my brain into thinking like, we did it.
It's over.
Yeah. But it ain't over, bro. That's a quarter of the way there. And I'm on lead card the next day, and I go out and shoot not a great round, but like I didn't like shoot myself out of it. I think I dropped to like 6th or 7th place, which sure. isn't awful. And, you know, the best players in the world ended up kicking into gear and getting on the lead card, which makes sense. But I knew that, you know, the work still wasn't done. But then I found myself in the 3rd round playing with the same group minus one person. I played chase card with James Conrad, Matty O, and Corey Ellis. That was our lead card the 2nd round. All 3 of those players have been throwing a disc longer than I've been alive.
That's probably true, yeah.
Isn't that crazy? No, we talked about it that day. Like, that is the absolute truth. Like, I was born in 2000. They have all been throwing a disc since before 2000, and that was our lead card at a major. Then the next day, everyone but James stays on the same card. So it's me, Matty O, and Corey again.
Yeah.
And all this practice of me sticking to my guns and throwing Casey White's shot, not worrying about anybody else's throws or disc selection or shot shape, anything. Then I find myself taking Corey Ellis's shot and being like, oh, Corey's throwing a 9-speed. Why am I throwing a DD3? Oh, well, don't throw the DD3 too far. And then I find myself missing my line. And I'm like asking myself, I'm like, why? What was the point of coming out to practice if now in round three you're going to be second-guessing yourself because Corey Ellis, who throws 200 feet farther than you, is discing down? Like, this isn't the plan at all. And throughout the weekend, like the second half in particular, I found myself struggling a little bit there. And I would say it definitely cost me some strokes, but nothing too major. But I ended up actually falling down to 22nd and not securing USGGC spot, not securing my best major finish of my career. I tied my best major finish at 22nd.
Yeah.
And that was kind of like that was a shot to the heart. Like I didn't keep my head in the game. I set my goals a little too shallow, like kind of thinking I wasn't capable of ultra greatness and thinking I was only capable of greatness. You know what I mean? And this year, I'm going to do the exact same thing. I'm going to go out there earlier than anybody else is going to go out there. I'm going to play more practice rounds than anybody else is going to get all by myself with my music in and my whole entire zone and just...
Yeah. Well, I think that's awesome that you found that strategy and that, you know, the schedule kind of lines up so that you're missing a silver event. You could miss Music City. Which is an Elite Series event.
I am missing it.
Okay. So there's a spot in the field if anybody needs it. I guess I'm interested in how you resolve the idea of playing Casey White's game, just like brutishly efficient, exactly what you practiced, versus the like really fluid way of trying to play the most challenging shot you can think of. You know, both in a tournament.
Uh-huh.
Is there any conflict there, or do you feel like kind of testing yourself to expand what you're capable of has translated into more confidence in doing the basic things?
I would say definitely the translation of adapting to a new play style in order to cover all bases as far as throwing capability, wet forehand or backhand. From hyzer all the way to the most extreme anhyzer, I've basically developed myself to find myself being able to throw any disc in my bag at any shot at any moment. And a lot of my play in my early professional career was based around, like I said, that overstable sidearm.
Yeah.
And then once I started to play more like the long courses on tour, like I didn't want to trust the understable hyzer flip on like distant shots. So I was smashing these big anhyzer backhands. But then I found a hole in my game, and the person I actually found myself recently starting to kind of emulate their shot shaping, disc selection, all that stuff is Steve Brinster.
Who is hyzer guy all day.
Because Steve Brinster covers every single one of my weakest spots in my game, which is standstill backhand, stupid understable putter flip shots, like mid-range chip shots. Like those are difficult shots for my game. At least they were. Mm-hmm. So recently, I would say in the last 9 months, since last June, I have incorporated much more understable discs in my bag. And basically, every single practice round I play, I throw one tournament shot, which would typically be sidearm, overstable, whatever.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then I'll take out my D-line MD or my super flippy P2, or I'll pull out a standstill driver. And I'll throw those shots and challenge myself.
Yeah.
So not only am I throwing the shot that I know I'm capable of, but I'm also working in the new...
hard shot.
Yes. Not so much hard, but like hard for Casey White.
Yeah.
And the more I do that, the more I find myself actually realizing like, this is the shot. And I'm finding myself pulling out those decisions on the fly, actually. At the Wintertime Open... I couldn't get hole 18's upshot right, or tee shot right. It's a 350-foot shot to clear a Mando, and then it's a dog leg to the left.
Mm-hmm.
Mid-range was not comfortable in the wind, and if I really smack on a fairway driver, it might go OB long, so I was just not really liking it. I messed up the mid-range in round one, and I looked at my buddy Trevin, and I was just like, I think I'm going standstill tomorrow. And he was like, really? I'm like, I mean, I don't think I'm going to be able to practice it, but like, if I look at it and it feels right, I'm doing it. And step up to hole 18, and there was not a single thought in my mind that told me I wasn't going standstill. That's mind it. You, I haven't thrown a standstill on this hole ever. And I very rarely actually standstill the disc I'm about to throw.
Mm-hmm.
But I hyzer flipped it right at the Mando tree, turned it away from it, and it was in a perfect spot. And I was like, yep, like, you are capable. And just those one step at a time evolves my game farther into like the, I'm challenging myself with this tough shot, but now that challenge is becoming confidence because I'm executing.
That's awesome. Casey, I'm really excited to see how you, you know, continue to grow, expand your skill set and your game. Thank you for your silly story and your serious stories. If you have positive things to say about the show, you can find me, Andrew Fish, on Instagram and Twitter at fish58320. And if you have complaints about the show, you can reach Casey at
CaseyWhite4 on Instagram.
Anywhere else? You got a YouTube channel, do you not?
Yeah, YouTube, Casey White Disc Golf.
All right, thank you so much for joining me. That's all for this episode of the Fish Golf Broadcast. But be sure to check out previous episodes and subscribe wherever fine podcasts are sold. Check out Fish Golf Broadcast hats and other apparel at discgolfbra.com and badger your friends until they listen too. Join us next time as I goad yet another guest into starting a fight with another touring player, campsite host, or toll booth attendant on the Fish Golf Broadcast.